You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney, and I'm the director of Whale Scout. Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast. Today, we are joined live in studio with David Bain. He's been a guest on the show a couple other times, and he is celebrating 40 years of killer whale research. And so we're going to pick his brain and hear stories about the last 40 years he spent studying killer whales, and challenges, successes, and just good stories all around. First, I want to tell you a little bit about what was going on this weekend. I just got back from Port Angeles, where Whale Scout team and friends were restoring the beach area near the estuary of the Elwha River, where it comes into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And as many of you know, that in the last 5 years or so, the two dams on the river were taken down, and about a century worth of sediment that was blocked behind the dams in the slow-moving water was released and could go down the river, flow out, and basically create a brand new beach. And this beach is in a spot where we planted 800 different plants. We had five different species, and they help sort of establish the beach and hold the sediment there so that the estuary can do its job. And the juvenile fish that are salmon that are coming out of the Elwha River can spend a little time there transitioning from freshwater to saltwater and then move on. It's also great for forage fish and eelgrass. You know, before, the beach was large cobbles, no fine-grained sediments at all. And so things like kelp were actually growing there. And then when you add in these fine-grained, you know, more like beach sands, eelgrass is able to grow and create a new sort of habitat that is better for our wild salmon, which of course is great for our killer whales. So I'm going to be posting photos. There are some up already on Facebook, but we're going to post a write-up on our website, whalescout.org, so you can read about how the day went. And I want to give a huge shout-out, thank you, to Lori Gogich for coordinating this event with the Lower Elwha Klallam Tribe. She also rented out a hostel for our volunteer group, made a delicious chili dinner for everybody, coordinated watching a movie, Return of the River, which was a fantastic film if you haven't seen it yet, all about the Elwha River dam removal process. And Lori she did everything for this project, and I cannot say thank you enough. If you missed this one but want to join us at another event, our hero, Lori, again, is a forest steward at Idlewood Park in Redmond. And on February 24th, we are going to be doing a restoration event there as well at Idlewood Creek. More information, again, at whalescout.org. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome David Bain. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast, and we are joined today in studio with David Bain, who is celebrating 40 years of killer whale research. Dave, welcome back.
Thank you.
And so you had posted early this year that you were celebrating 40 years of killer whale research, and it created quite a stir on your Facebook page. A lot of people congratulating you and talking about old memories, and so I'm glad to have you here to share some stories and talk about everything you want to talk about. And how did you first get interested and started with killer whales? Do you remember the first time that you ever saw a killer whale?
Probably would have been when I was about nine. I went to Miami's aquarium and saw the whales there. And I grew up out in the woods, so I kind of, you know, always liked animals. And it happened that marine animals were what I was interested in when I started college. So I went to New College in Florida, which offers independent study projects, and I did my first one with bottlenose dolphins and my second one with killer whales, and was supposed to be a month-long project, and now I'm 40 years into it.
And what was it that drew you to marine animals and whales?
Well, kind of interested in all animals, but I think what made me stay with it is that they're complicated enough to be interesting, but simple enough that you get answers as you go along.
And you went to college also in Santa Cruz. What was that like?
That was wonderful. We had some of the best marine mammal scientists like Ken Norris and Bernie LaBeouf there. And because of that, they drew in experts from around the world. And we also had a lot of graduate students who are very high caliber people as well. So we had, you know, like 35 graduate students working on marine mammals. Alexei Yablokov, who eventually became Minister of Environment in Russia, came over and met with the grad students and told us about the pollution problems in the Black Sea that had rendered essentially nearly all the harbor seals there sterile. And he's the one that went on to blow the whistle on illegal Soviet whaling and getting that shut down after the breakup of the Soviet Union.
So beyond your graduate work, did he have an influence on your career beyond there?
Oh, well, I studied Russian, so I read quite a bit of the Russian literature, but, he wasn't, someone who had direct impact, but, obviously toxins have become a big problem with killer whales over here, so seeing how bad it could get if we don't get our act together quickly, is something that I keep in mind as I'm doing my work.
And, I spent a little bit of time looking through your CV and at your research over time and where you began, and you spent, you can correct me if I'm wrong, about over 20 years as the research director, or not as a research director, but 20 years working at Marine World. What was that like? Can you describe some of your research on captive whales?
That was very interesting. What I tried to do was experimental work with the captive animals and then do observations in the wild to compare whether what we were finding in captivity was at least consistent with what was going on in the wild. Also, there were times that you'd have questions from the wild observations that you'd want to come back to captivity to try to address. So, for example, one of the things we've been quite concerned about is the effects of boat noise. And in a captive setting, you can do experimental work and you can play a tone and say, okay, how loud does this need to be for you to be able to hear it? And then what happens if I play noise at the same time? How much louder does it need to get for you to be able to detect it? And those are things that, without those captive studies, we'd just be doing guesswork based on the wild observations.
So do you feel that that research that you did is being used now to, is being applied now to understand what's going on with southern residents in the San Juans?
Oh, to some degree it is, but there's a reluctance of the regulatory agencies to act on best available science. So even though we've figured things out, it's hard to get the regulatory agencies to implement actions on that. For example, with noise, they've done work to address noise from the commercial whale watching industry, but they're not addressing noise from sport fishing boats or commercial traffic and things like that. So it's kind of been frustratingly slow seeing, research turned into policy. We also did research looking at the survival of bottlenose dolphin calves in relationship to their mother's toxin level. And we found a very clear relationship where females that were very clean were almost always successful rearing their calves, and females with high toxin levels almost never successfully reared calves, and ones in the middle had intermediate success rates.
And this was in captivity?
This was in captivity, uh-huh. So you don't have to worry about predation or disease or lack of food or any of the confounding variables you deal with in the wild. But again, we're pretty slow on trying to do cleanups of toxic chemicals. So we know it needs to be done. We know it would help, but the funding isn't there to make it happen.
And even still, there's work being done with SeaWorld killer whales on toxins in calves, correct? I mean, is it furthering the work that you've done and others have done, or repeating it? And is there more to be done still with research in captivity to be applied to wild whales?
Well, kind of yes and no. I think what they're finding with the killer whales is basically the same thing we found with the bottlenose dolphins. So it's something that, you know, we could have started acting on, you know, 20 years ago instead of, you know, continuing to do research now and say, you know, we're not going to do it till we get this project done. But that said, you know, there is a possibility that dolphins process chemicals differently than killer whales do. They're closely related, so bottlenose dolphins are a good model, but they're not necessarily a perfect model. And we're also recognizing that we have different species of killer whale. So, you know, we might do a study on an Atlantic killer whale and find out it doesn't exactly apply to southern resident killer whale.
And having worked both with wild whales and captive whales, what did you prefer?
Well, I prefer doing both because you get to learn different things in the different settings. So, you know, again, with the captive whales, you can see every move they make. You can hear every sound they make. You can have a record of every fish they ate. You know, you can monitor the respiration continuously, so you know exactly how much energy they've burned. You can collect samples from them voluntarily, like they'll come up and pee in a cup for you, or, you know, you don't have to follow them around with a dog to get a fecal sample. You can collect blow samples very easily, you know, a lot more easily than sending out a drone or doing it with a 25-foot pole. But at the same time, the captive situation is very simplified. You don't have as many animals. You don't have the multi-generational social structures that you see in the wild. You don't have the fish and fusion society structure. So there's a lot that you cannot look at in captivity. So being able to go out to the wild and come back is really valuable. You know, for example, for the dialect stories, one of the key features of dialects is that they're learned, and we don't really have a way to demonstrate learning in the wild. But in captivity, you can take a whale in, you know, document its natal dialect, and then have it be reared with other whales that had a different dialect. And then when that young whale adopts the dialect of the older whale, you can say that, you know, it learned that. And you can say it's not a, you know, developmental thing, because you have another whale that started with that dialect and was reared in a different setting, and it did not develop the same dialect as the other one did. So, you know, being able to go back and forth and, you know, have questions in one place be answered in the others, you know, I think was a very rich approach to doing things.
And if you were still working with killer whales in captivity, what sort of work do you think would be interesting to do?
You know, I think the development of vocalization in more detail. So it seems like a lot of that happens in the first 6 months of life. So it would be nice to follow that process more carefully. In the wild, you know, usually we don't see them until they already have their dialect, as they're already, you know, 6 or 8 months old by the time we see them. You know, I think healthcare is something that could be really valuable. So if we can figure out how to treat whales in the wild, we may be able to prevent some of the mortalities we're seeing. So, you know, the drone work is getting very good at picking out which whales are about to die and which ones aren't. So, if, you know, we've found a way to administer antibiotics, or you know, perhaps do some supplemental feeding to get whales through you know, a disease outbreak, that could be the difference between the population making it and not making it. For example, there was a cryptococcus outbreak that I think killed a couple people. It killed a lot of pets. And we also had a big die-off of harbor porpoises that was linked to that. We also had the disappearance of several southern residents, and nobody found their bodies, so we don't know what they died of. But it's possible that, you know, they'd been exposed to that same pathogen. And if that's something that we could have treated, you know, we may have been able to prevent most of those deaths. And, you know, we've got a population so small that every whale matters now.
And working back and forth and captivity with wild whales, you know, this area has a lot of activists who are very against captivity. Were you ever criticized for your work in captivity?
Yeah, I've been criticized for it. And, you know, I think there are some places that treated killer whales as part of the revenue stream, but there were a couple places that took the mandate to give back to the wild seriously. So, for example, I did my work out of Marine World, and, you know, we did the rescue of the killer whales up at Barnes Lake, where we saved 7 whales. And, you know, in its entire history, I think it only brought 5 killer whales into captivity. So, you know, we saved more whales there than were ever taken into captivity. And that, you know, laid the groundwork for the rescue of Springer several years later. So, you know, there are ways to give back to wild whales. You know, we've been very active in supporting conservation issues. And, you know, they tried to be accurate about the educational material they provided. And sometimes they'd make a joke of it. So, you know, they talk about how whales went back into the ocean 65 million years ago last Tuesday. And obviously the last Tuesday was an exaggeration, but, you know, trying to, you know, make information delivery fit in with the entertainment. So, you know, it's different than just, you know, trying to show off the athletic ability of their trainers and things like that.
And in your opinion, you know, in the news lately, the Vancouver Aquarium is ending their captive cetacean program, and there's legislation in the state of Washington to ban captive cetaceans. Do you have an opinion on those things?
Well, I think the rescue and rehabilitation role is something that we'll miss if we don't keep it somehow. You know, I'm kind of feeling with research right now, there is a backlog between what we know and policy implementation. So there's probably not the urgency to get research data in that there was, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But I think that, you know, science is something where as you go along, you tend to end up with more questions than you started with. So, you know, I think we'll also miss places like Vancouver Aquarium that did support a lot of research. But as technology is getting better, we're getting more information from wild whales than we were able to do 40 years ago.
And on your Facebook post, you had joked about potentially writing a book and having the title be Science on a Shoestring and a Broken One at That. Can you tell some stories about your science on a shoestring?
Okay, yeah. Well, funding has never been plentiful, so that particular thing refers to a rescue we were doing of 3 stranded cetaceans, and you know, they came in about the same time, and they needed 24-hour-a-day care. So I lived in the sea lion cage next to the pool, so that I didn't have commute time to worry about. And, you know, if there was time for a 15-minute nap, I'd go for it. You know, at the time I had worn out shoes, so my toes were kind of sticking out through it. And, you know, the shoelaces were broken and tied back together. And somebody decided to put a sign on the cage that said, "This animal does bite." So I'm kind of sitting there with my toes sticking through the holes in the shoes and, you know, the sign, you know, pointing out that I bite. But we did successfully rehabilitate all 3 of the dolphins. So, you know, it was worth the trouble.
Yes.
And then I guess there was another thing where, you know, for new technology, you know, we didn't have the funding to go out and buy it. So as students, we had to build the new tools we needed. And I had one where I was building a circuit and I had all these wires going all over everywhere. And I made the mistake of trying to do it all with one color of wire.
Oh, gosh.
So that got to be known as the hopeless tangle. And then the next generation I did go with different colored wires. So that became the hopeful tangle.
And you said a chapter title, Mosquitoes Bite Whales Too.
Yeah. So turns out that mosquitoes literally do bite whales, at least in captivity. So kind of, you know, you're out collecting data and you're getting bitten by mosquitoes. And then every once in a while you see the whale shudder as they're getting bitten by a mosquito also. And it's kind of a point that I guess, you know, bad things happen to good people or good whales, and, you know, you just have to deal with it.
And I want you to tell more about the story of the seven rescued killer whales in Barnes Lake and other rehab. You said the three dolphins, those seven killer whales, and who else?
Well, there was Springer. So she was the one that I worked with her mother when her mother was a two-year-old. She was one of the whales I did my graduate work on. And her mother passed away. And she was adopted by a different pod. And apparently she got sick, so she got separated from her adoptive pod and just kind of wandered aimlessly till she ended up at Vashon Island. And she was sort of able to make a living there. So she was catching fish, but she had a lot of parasites she was feeding. So, you know, she wasn't able to feed herself and the parasites. So, you know, we eventually convinced National Marine Fisheries it would be in her best interest to bring her into captivity for a short period of time, treat her medical problems, and then send her back home. And one of the issues they had was, where is home? Because Ken Balcom had come down from San Juan Island and said she was a transient. And we got a skin sample from her and sent it down to Southwest Fisheries Science Center, and they said she was a southern resident. And Graham Ellis looked at a picture of her and, you know, thought she was this little whale from G Pod. So, you know, she belonged up north, but in a pod that's hard to find. And I listened to her calls and decided she was an A4 pod whale. And since there was only one A4 pod whale her age, you know, we figured it had to be A73. So we had all these different alleged identifications, and then we had a meeting to talk about what to do with her. And Ken said, well, what I actually meant is she's not any of the southern residents. So I assumed she was a transient, but she could be any whale that's not a southern resident. And Southwest Fisheries Science Center said, well, we misread the sequence. She's actually a northern resident. And then the interesting thing is, after she was last seen with her mother in British Columbia, she was seen with her mother in Alaska, and she'd picked up a new scratch. And it's that when she came back to British Columbia, she hung out with the G's. So Graham had the right whale. He just didn't recognize that it was the same whale he'd seen the year before.
What a puzzle.
Yeah. So, you know, once we got the photo from Alaska that, you know, match both the, I guess it was the 2000 photo from BC and the 2001 photo from BC, we go, okay, she really is A73. And then we could plan accordingly. And I told them, you know, A4s should be in Johnson Strait on July 14th. So, you know, we get her back there on that date and everything will be fine.
You predicted the future?
I did.
Wow.
And it worked.
And you weren't even at 40 years then.
No. yeah, that was, I guess less, that was only about 25. So
now, I mean, you could save the world. I mean,
Well, I'm trying. I'm not sure that I can, but yeah, I think, you know, in the last few years, I've put a lot more emphasis on action than research, because like I said, there's this backlog of data that hasn't been converted to policy, but there are things that we know we need to do, and there are things we can do without the federal government taking the lead. So I've been putting a lot of emphasis on those things and trying to demonstrate, you know, here's what the average person can do. So, you know, we talk about killer whales dying the death of 1,000 cuts. And I like to say the treatment for the death of 1,000 cuts is 1,000 Band-Aids. It's not heart surgery. So everybody knows how to put a Band-Aid on. So, you know, if we can get, you know, the 500,000 people who watch whales in Washington and southern BC each year, you know, each putting their own little Band-Aid on, then we can make a lot of progress. And, you know, eventually government will come in and do the big things like tearing down the Elwha dams that need to get done as well. But while we're waiting for more things like that to happen, you know, we can be doing a lot of repairing restoration work, which, you know, is as easy as working in your garden. So, you know, there's no reason people can't be doing a lot of that.
I have a few Facebook questions that I'll go to. Carrie Kirkland asks about tracking killer whales. You know, there's different suction cup tags, satellite tags, and now scat detection dogs. What's the newest that's right around the corner that's going to just be a big breakthrough for killer whale research or for whale research in general?
Well, I think drones are kind of the big breakthrough, and I guess as we go along, they'll get better range and they'll have better cameras. We may also have some, you know, autonomous vessels that can follow killer whales around. So quite a while back, I had a graduate student who, you know, had a little like 6-foot catamaran that she put a computer and a depth sounder on, and you know, she could remote control it so it would follow the whales around and then, you know, transmit back sonar images to show where the whales were underwater. And I think, you know, with the newer technology, we can automate that, and you know, they'll need a lot less power than the flying drones. So I think that kind of technology could give us the tracking data that we've previously been getting from things like satellite tags. And with the death of a satellite tagged whale, there's reluctance to do more of that. So I think, you know, a combination of aerial drones that can see down into the water and water-based drones that just kind of tell you, you know, how far offshore the whales are and whether they're off California or Nia Bay or wherever they happen to be. And then, you know, relaying that information back to the lab will probably be a valuable data source. And suction cup tags seem to be a safe way to get short-term data. And, you know, as we get those on whales in more and more parts of the world, you know, we'll find some interesting things on how deep they dive and, you know, what kind of maneuvers they go through when they're feeding and things like that.
And Kaylee Genther asks, who has been the most memorable person that you've worked with so far and why?
Oh, boy.
Like a whole cast of characters you could go through, perhaps.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, there's Rachel Smolker, who reminds me of your daughter because of the wonderful facial expressions she had. And you know, especially when things went wrong. So, you know, we one field season, we made a list of, you know, sort of fun names for things that went wrong, which was under the list of prangers of the Northwest coast of North America. So pranger was a, you know, Ken Norris term that he used for things crashing into each other and, you know, things going wrong as a result. But anyway, we kind of named the whole genus after Rachel Smolker, and you know, she went on to get the work with the Monkey Mia Dolphins going. So she is quite a memorable person. I think Janice Waite was probably the best research assistant I ever had. She's working at National Marine Fisheries now, still doing killer whale work with them and other work up in Alaska, doing some interesting things with right whales now, I think. You know, Chris Johnson was another very interesting one. So she's went on to do work on dolphin cognition, and I think she's at UC San Diego these days. And then, you know, there was Tom Kiekhafer, who was sort of a giant of a man. And, you know, if there was a log in the way, he'd just go over and pick it up and move it out of the way. So you didn't have to worry about tripping over it. And he was a very creative person, very thoughtful. Tom Jefferson's gone on to be very influential in both the Dawes porpoise world and the Gulf of California harbor porpoise world. So he's become a very strong player in the conservation community. So he's another one of those research assistants I'm very proud of.
Yeah. So,
you know, I think they've all been special in their own ways, and, you know, kind of would love to work with any of them again.
And is there anyone that mentored you, that you looked up to?
I had lots of mentors. Randy Wells was a graduate student in our lab, and, you know, he kind of took care of all the younger grad students, in addition to doing his work with the bottlenose dolphins in Sarasota. I think Bob Trivers was probably the most influential professor I ever had. Ken Norris was great. Bernie LaBeouf was great. And of course, Mike Bigg was, you know, probably the most important person for the killer whale work I was doing. And after I finished my last field season, I went over to visit him and stayed at his place for about 10 days. And, you know, we just get up in the morning and start talking about whales, and maybe by about 10 o'clock we get around saying good morning to each other and then go back to talking about whales. And, you know, we went through every whale in the northern community one by one, and, you know, I didn't leave till we talked about every single one of them. So that was one of the most magical experiences I've had in killer whale research.
Wow. One of the questions on Facebook was asked, do you have a favorite southern resident? Like, do you identify with any whale?
I still think of myself as a northern resident person. So
maybe a northern resident whale.
Yeah, so A42 was my favorite whale up there. So she was a young whale who was close related to the whale I was working with in captivity. But, you know, she'd come over to our boat and show off the salmon she caught, or, you know, she was a very active babysitter. And one of the studies we worked on, which was Janice Waite's master's thesis, was babysitting behavior in killer whales. So it was kind of, you know, fun watching her do her thing. And yeah, so she was just kind of this fun whale that didn't seem to be too worried about boats. And you know, kind of on the other extreme, we had G30 that people thought was dead for 4 years, because she'd see a boat and she'd go hide on the other side of the pod. And
wow,
one day we finally got over before she switched back to the other side and got a picture of her and said, yeah, she's still alive.
Wow. What do you think started that behavior? A bad interaction?
Well, she was probably a very old whale. So I think she goes back to the days before, you know, motorized boats were invented. So, you know, she's passed away since, for real, I think. but, you know, she was probably born in the early 1900s and, you know, probably didn't hear boats when she was growing up and, you know, didn't trust them. And, you know, we kind of remember that, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, people were still shooting at whales. So, you know, hearing a motorized vessel, you know, could mean to her you're about to get shot. So I think she wanted to stay at a safe distance. And, you know, the younger whales hopefully didn't have that getting shot at experience. So they were less nervous about the boats being around.
And what are you most proud of so far?
Probably the Barnes Lake killer whale rescue. So that was one where, it required precisely understanding whale behavior, required working with people, it required working through the bureaucracy. Because when we first proposed to go up and rescue them, National Marine Fisheries said they'd be very happy to arrest me if I tried. So, we had to work through the bureaucracy to make it all legal. And, they actually sent somebody to participate in it. So, it kind of went from a criminal activity to a showcase activity.
So what happened?
There was a pod of offshore killer whales that ended up in a tide pool. And this was up in Alaska where they do things big. So their tide pool up there was like a mile across and, maybe 40 feet deep at the deepest. But it had two channels going in and out that, at low tide, it would drain the tide pool, and at high tide, it would fill it up again. And the guess is that they went in there after fish, and then when they tried to go back out, there would have been this kelp bed in the way that, when the current's right, it knocks the kelp down, but at slack, it just stands up, and then at low tide, there's not enough water for a whale to swim through. So we had to figure out, what time the tide would be just right to get them through the kelp bed, and then how long it would take them to get from the main part of the tide pool to the exit of the channel so that they would arrive at the kelp bed at the right time. And, we had to figure out how they'd react to people and how that might change with where they were. And so we kind of drew up a plan and got the neighbors who live near the tide pool to come out in boats and bang on pipes. And, we kind of drove the whales toward the exit, and there was this little side pocket, next to the main channel leading out. And, when I drew it up the night before, I had the whales going into that and then, having to herd them back out and get them going on the right track. But I didn't tell anybody else that. So when they went in there, everybody else freaked out. And I'm going, no, this is according to plan. But, we did, set up a barrier so that, when they came back out, they wouldn't turn and go back towards the tide pool. So we got them out of there and going the right direction, and they hit the kelp bed at just the right time and went out. And, once they were out, they started swimming really fast toward this double rainbow. And then, kind of at the end of the rainbow, they stopped and looked like they were doing foraging behavior. So it might have been, the first time they'd eaten in, 4 to 6 weeks. So
gosh,
they seemed to be quite happy to be out and, where they could eat something bigger than a sculpin. there were also harbor seals in the tide pool, which they didn't bother. So, even when they're starving to death, they won't.
It's fascinating.
Eat marine mammals, but all seven of the whales we got out were resighted afterwards. So it was a successful rescue for those seven. However, there were two that died before we got the chance to drive them out. So, it wasn't a complete success. And, that time working through the bureaucracy, probably resulted in two whales dying that we might have been able to get out if they just said, go for it.
And what's the one thing that you hope people will take away from your research?
I hope they'll take away that these animals are special and they're worth saving, and that, they don't have to be extremely special. If everybody will put in, a couple hours of their time, maybe one or two weekends a year, that would make a tremendous difference for them. So, if we can, take into account that they have the special ability to develop dialects, which, is very rare among mammals. There are lots of birds that do it, but, mammals either don't learn their vocalizations at all, or they don't develop particular call types, like your dog learns to bark, but there's not one type of bark that you hear over and over again. So they've got, you know, these calls that you will hear over and over again, and it depends on who they're raised with, you know, what set of calls they'll make. And, you know, I think they're pretty special. They've got this altruistic relationship where, you know, they will, you know, do favors for other whales. And, you know, it's kind of, you know, a nice kind of organism to have around because, you know, you like it when people help you out when you need it, or whales help other whales out when they need it. So I think that's another thing that makes them special. And, you know, because we've done things like overfishing and destroying habitat for fish to be reared in, and, you know, we're making a lot of noise in the ocean, and we're spilling oil in the ocean and dumping toxic chemicals into the ocean, you know, we've made it very difficult for them to survive. And I think if we could all take a little time out of our days every once in a while to try to make up for that, that would be, I think, the most important thing that could come out of my work.
And I can't help but notice that the last 40 years for you have followed a similar trajectory to another killer whale researcher, Alexandra Morton, mm-hmm. who had done some captive work, worked on whales in the wild, and then now is spending a lot of time focused on salmon. What was your experience working with her, and have you influenced each other?
Yeah, and actually, you know, we both worked with captive whales from the same pod. They were different aquariums, so, you know, it was kind of fun getting together in the early days and saying, well, you know, where do you draw the lines between these calls? And, you know, we kind of had, you know, lumpers and splitters, and, you know, we could agree, well, yeah, this is a split of those two. And, you know, we kind of looked at that. And unfortunately, I was with her when her husband passed away. So that was, I think, a traumatic experience for everyone involved. You know, I think she's gone through the same recognition that, you know, you can go out and collect data and satisfy curiosity and do good basic science, but these whales are special, and, you know, we can be doing better things with our time than that basic science. So, you know, she's doing a lot of work on survival of salmon out at sea. And I'm living inland now, so it's kind of easier for me to work on survival of salmon inland. And, you know, there's a lot that needs to be done. So if we each, you know, fill our own niche, you know, hopefully everything will get done at some point.
And so what's next? What's exciting you right now, and what are you working towards?
Oh, I think trying to rebuild salmon stocks is a big thing. So there are a number of dams that could be torn down. There are a lot of smaller scale things we can do to improve survivorship of salmon between dams or in places where dams are not an issue. So trying to get to work on that. You know, National Marine Fisheries has its recovery plan, and Canada has its recovery strategy. And getting those from being reports that sit on a shelf collecting dust to people actually doing things to make a difference, I think, is kind of where I'm focusing my effort these days.
And is there any other last words, anything else that you want to share with everyone listening?
I think my most special moment with wild whales was what we call the Northern Lights Night.
Ooh.
And that was, I think, maybe, I don't remember if that was my first or second field season in Johnson Strait. But anyway, you know, we were interested in what the whales do at night. And we knew there was going to be a full moon. So, you know, we kind of geared up to spend the night following whales. And it turned out that, you know, in the north, they're in the third of the sky, it was filled with northern lights. And then kind of in the, you know, southern sky, we had this full moon, and we had about 80 whales out with us. And a lot of them were our clan whales. And our clan has the best sounds of all the whales I've listened to. So we're getting this fantastic acoustic show on the hydrophone, and we've got this fantastic light show in the sky. And you know, it was just a very special experience being out there, because it wasn't, you know, just the whales doing their, you know, usual interesting things. You know, we had the lights going on at the same time, and you know, there was no wind, so you know, sea conditions were perfect. And you know, it's just one of those things that hasn't happened again since.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds absolutely magical. Wow. Any other experiences that could even come close to that?
Well, I think the, you know, rescue in Barnes Lake was another one. You know, there are lots of little things whales do that are cute, like, you know, A42 bringing the salmon over to show off what she'd caught. And then, you know, there are other things like, you know, whales swimming towards each other and not recognizing who they are. And then, you know, using calls that cannot be repeated in polite company. And then, you know, the other whale says, you know, hey, chill out, it's just me. And they kind of go, oh, sorry. And, you know, other times, you know, it'll be, you know, transients will hear residents coming and they go over to the other side of the channel, or residents will hear white-sided dolphins coming and the residents go over to the other side of the channel. And, you know, I guess there are other things where, you know, you get, you know, a whale watch operator standing up to the Navy. So, you know, in 2003, when the Shoup was coming through blasting its sonar, there were a lot of people trying to get them to turn it off, but, you know, Jim Maya was one of the whale watch operators up there, and he finally cracked the code for how to connect to the naval vessel and get them to turn the sonar off. So, you know, he kind of realized that, you know, there are lots of people out there that are trying to help, and, you know, who's the right person in one situation may be the wrong person in a different one, but, you know, you want to have that diversity of approaches so that somebody's there to get it done when it needs to get done.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing for certain, is that there are so many people who care so deeply about these whales that it gives me a lot of hope that, you know, we can turn the tide for these whales and get everyone who doing everything that they think is the right thing to help these whales. You know, Dave, I want to thank you so much for coming in studio. Is there anything else we can share with our listeners, or links we can put up on the website?
Oh, well, there are lots of groups that have information. You know, there's Orca Network and Orca Conservancy, and of course, Whale Scout. You know, Whale Museum has some information, Center for Whale Research. So there are lots of places to be looking. There's a group called Our Sound, Our Salmon that's working on closing Atlantic fish farming in the U.S. because Washington State is the only one that's left doing it. And, you know, there are three bills going through the state legislature right now targeting to get the fish farms closed. You know, at the same time, we want to be respectful of Native Americans who are trying to farm native species to, you know, perpetuate their culture, because, you know, the whales aren't the only one missing the fish that used to be here. So there are a lot of tribes that, you know, opened their border to the U.S. instead of building a wall in exchange for, you know, half the fish. And half the fish was a lot more back then than it is now. So, you know, I think that, you know, things like aquaculture and hatcheries as a conservation measure are good things. But when it becomes a purely commercial venture, you know, you start creating problems that, you know, are not offset. And, you know, it's kind of the same thing in the aquarium industry. You had some aquariums that, you know, took conservation seriously and others that didn't. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, really needed to treat the two approaches differently. And then Governor Inslee has talked about creating a task force that, you know, will hopefully, you know, take on the mission of getting these recovery plans put into action. And, you know, there's, I guess, a lot of skepticism in Washington because we've had a lot of groups that, you know, the current one is the Puget Sound Partnership that have been tasked with that mission and not succeeded very well. So we don't know if this will be, you know, the next generation that doesn't make it, or if this will be the embodiment that finally succeeds. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do to help Puget Sound. And, you know, we see all these beautiful pictures that are misleading because they don't show you what's underwater. More importantly, what's not underwater. They don't show you the toxic chemicals that are there. So, you know, it's very easy to think everything's fine when it's really not.
Yeah, I am following the news as well as you are, and I will continue to post news stories and updates on our Facebook page. You can follow at facebook.com/whalescout. And anything else that you want to share with me, Dave, I'll gladly put up.
Okay.
And I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. As always, you can find our podcast on iTunes and on our website. On iTunes, you can hit subscribe, and these podcasts will be sent directly to your phone so you can listen wherever you are. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Maladif est trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé qu'écrasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée. J'ai